shall inherit the earth. And it says, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for they shall see God. Lloyd was nodding and crying. For a moment it seemed that a blazing corona had formed around Flagg's head, a light so bright that if Lloyd looked at it for long it would burn his eyes to cinders. Then it was gone, if it had ever been there at all, and it must not have been because Lloyd had not even lost his night vision. "Now you aren't very bright," Flagg said, "but you are the first, and I have the feeling you might be very loyal. You and I, Lloyd, we're going to go far. It's a good time for people like us. Everything is starting up for us. All I need is your word."
Word?
That we're going to stick together, you and me. No denials. No falling asleep on guard duty. There will be others very soon. They're on their way west already. But for now, there's just us. I'll give you the key if you give me your promise.
Promise,
Lloyd said, and the words seemed to hang in the air, vibrating strangely. He listened to that vibration, his head cocked to one side, and he could almost see those two words, glowing as darkly as the aurora borealis reflected in a dead man's eye. Then he forgot about them as the tumblers made their half turns inside the lockbox. The next moment the lockbox fell at Flagg's feet, tendrils of smoke seeping from it. "You're free, Lloyd. Come on out." Unbelieving, Lloyd touched the bars hesitantly, as if they might burn him. And indeed they did seem warm, but when he pushed, the door slid back easily and soundlessly. He stared at his savior, those burning eyes. Something was placed in his hand. The key. "It's yours now, Lloyd."
"Mine?"
Flagg grabbed Lloyd's fingers and closed them around it, and Lloyd felt it move in his hand, felt it change. He uttered a hoarse cry, and his fingers sprang open. The key was gone, and in its place was the black stone with the red flaw. He held it up, wondering, and turned it this way and that. Now the red flaw looked like a key, now like a skull, now like a bloody half-closed eye again.
"Mine," Lloyd answered himself.
This time he closed his hand with no help, holding the stone savagely tight.
"Shall we get some dinner?" Flagg asked. "We've got a lot of driving to do tonight."
"Dinner," Lloyd said.
"All right."
"There's such a lot to do," Flagg said happily, "and we're going to move very fast." They walked toward the stairs together, past the dead men in their cells. When Lloyd stumbled in weakness, Flagg seized his arm above the elbow and bore him up. Lloyd turned and looked into that grinning face with something more than gratitude. He looked at Flagg with something like love. Chapter 40. Nick Andros lay sleeping, but not quiet, on the bunk in Sheriff Baker's office. He was naked except for his shorts, and his body was lightly oiled with sweat. His last thought before sleep had taken him the night before was that he would be dead by morning. The dark man that had consistently haunted his feverish dreams would somehow break through that last thin barrier of sleep and take him away. It was strange. The eye which Ray Booth had gouged into darkness had hurt for 2 days. Then, on the third, the feeling that giant calipers had been screwed into his head had faded down to a dull ache. There was nothing but a gray blur when he looked through that eye now, a gray blur in which shapes sometimes moved or seemed to move. But it wasn't the eye injury which was killing him. It was the bullet graze down his leg. He had gone without disinfecting it. The pain in his eye had been so great that he had barely been aware of it. The graze ran shallowly along his right thigh and ended at the knee. The next day he had examined the bullet hole in his pants where the slug had exited with some wonder. And on that next day, June 30th, the wound had been red along the edges and all the muscles of that leg seemed to ache. He had limped down to Dr. Soames's office and had gotten a bottle of hydrogen peroxide. He had poured the whole bottle of peroxide over the bullet wound, which was about 10 inches long. It had been a case of locking the barn door after the horse had been stolen. By that evening his entire right leg was throbbing like a rotten tooth, and under the skin he could see the telltale red lines of blood poisoning radiating out from the wound, which had only begun to scab over. On July 1st he had gone down to Soames's office again and had rummaged through his drug closet, looking for penicillin. He found some, and after a moment's hesitation he swallowed both of the pills in one of the sample packets. He was well aware that he would die if his body reacted strongly against the penicillin, but he thought the alternative might be an even nastier death. The infection was racing, racing. The penicillin did not kill him, but there was no noticeable improvement either. By yesterday noon he had been running a high fever, and he suspected he had been delirious a great deal of the time. He had plenty of food, but didn't want to eat it. All he seemed to want to do was drink cup after cup of the distilled water in the cooler which stood in Baker's office. That water had been almost gone when he fell asleep, or passed out, last night, and Nick had no idea how he might get more. In his feverish state, he didn't care much. He would die soon, and there would be nothing to worry about anymore. He was not crazy about the idea of dying, but the thought of having no more pain or worry was a great relief. His leg throbbed and itched and burned. His sleep those days and nights after the killing of Ray Booth had not seemed like sleep at all. His dreams were a flood. It seemed that everyone he had ever known was coming back for a curtain call. Rudy Sparkman pointing at the white sheet of paper. You are this blank page. His mother tapping lines and circles she had helped him make on another white page, marring its purity. It says Nick Andros, honey. That's you. Jane Baker, her face turned aside on the pillow, saying, Johnny, my poor Johnny. In his dreams, Dr. Soames asked John Baker again and again to take off his shirt, and again Ray Booth said, Hold him. I'm gonna mess him up. Sucker hit me. Hold him. Unlike all the other dreams he had had in his life, Nick did not have to lip-read these. He could actually hear what people were saying. The dreams were incredibly vivid. They would fade as the pain in his leg brought him close to waking. Then a new scene would appear as he sank down into sleep again. There were people he had never seen in two of the dreams, and these were the dreams he remembered the most clearly when he woke up. He was on a high place. The land was spread out below him like a relief map. It was desert land, and the stars above had the mad clarity of altitude. There was a man beside him. No, not a man, but the shape of a man. As if the figure had been cut from the fabric of reality, and what really stood beside him was a negative man, a black hole in the shape of a man. And the voice of this shape whispered, Everything you see will be yours if you fall down on your knees and worship me. Nick shook his head, wanting to step away from that awful drop, afraid the shape would stretch out its black arms and push him over the edge. Why don't you speak? Why do you just shake your head? In the dream, Nick made the gesture he had made so many times in the waking world, a laying of his finger over his lips, then the flat of his hand against his throat. And then he heard himself say in a perfectly clear, rather beautiful voice, I can't talk. I am mute. But you can. If you want to, you can. Nick reached out to touch the shape then, his fear momentarily swept away in a flood of amazement and burning joy. But as his hand neared that figure's shoulder, it turned ice cold, so cold it seemed that he had burned it. He jerked it away with ice crystals forming on the knuckles, and it came to him. He could hear the dark shape's voice, the far-off cry of a hunting nightbird, the endless whine of the wind. He was struck mute all over again by the wonder of it. There was a new dimension to the world he had never missed, because he had never experienced it, and now it had fallen into place. He was hearing sounds. He seemed to know what each was without being told. They were pretty, pretty sounds. He ran his fingers back and forth across his shirt and marveled at the swift whisper of his nails on the cotton. Then the dark man was turning toward him, and Nick was terribly afraid. This creature, whatever it was, performed no free miracles. If you fall down on your knees and worship me. And Nick put his hands over his face because he wanted all the things the black man shape had shown him from this high desert place. Cities, women, treasure, power. But most of all, He wanted to hear the entrancing sound his fingernails made on his shirt, the tick of a clock in an empty house after midnight, and the secret sound of rain. But the word he said was no, and then that freezing cold was on him again, and he had been pushed. He was falling end over end, screaming soundlessly as he tumbled through these cloudy depths, tumbled into the smell of corn? Yes, corn. This was the other dream. They blended together like this, with hardly a seam to show the difference. He was in the corn, the green corn, and the smell was summer earth and cow manure and growing things. He got to his feet and began to walk up the row he had found himself in, stopping momentarily as he realized he could hear the soft wicker of the wind flowing between the July corn's green, sword-like blades. And something else. Music? Yes, some sort of music. And in the dream he thought, so that's what they mean. It was coming from straight ahead, and he walked toward it, wanting to see if this particular succession of pretty sounds came from what was called piano or horn or cello or what. The hot smell of summer in his nostrils, the overarching blue sky above, that lovely sound. In this dream, Nick had never been happier, and as he neared the source, a voice joined the music, an old voice like dark leather, slurring the words a little as if the song was a stew, often reheated, that never lost its old savor. Mesmerized, Nick walked toward it. I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear fallen on my ear, the Son of God discloses. And he walks with me, and he talks with me, tells me I am his own, and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known. As the verse ended, Nick pushed through to the head of the row, and there in the clearing was a shack, not much more than a shanty, with a rusty trash barrel to the left and an old tire swing to the right. It hung from an apple tree that was gnarled but still green with lovely life. A porch slanted out from the house, a splintery old thing held up with old oil-clotted jack-lifters. The windows were open, and the kind summer breeze blew ragged white curtains in and out of them. From the roof, a peaked chimney of galvanized tin, dented and smoky, jutted at its own old, odd angle. This house sat in its clearing, and the corn stretched away in all four directions as far as the eye could see. It was broken only on the north by a dirt road that dwindled away to a point on the flat horizon. It was always then that Nick knew where he was, Polk County, Nebraska, west of Omaha and a little north of Osceola. Far up that dirt road was U.S. 30 and Columbus, sitting on the north bank of the Platte. Sitting on the porch was the oldest woman in America, a black woman with fluffy white thin hair. She is thin herself, wearing a house dress and specs. She looks thin enough for the high afternoon wind to just blow her away, tumble her into the high blue sky, and carry her perhaps all the way to Julesburg, Colorado. And the instrument she is playing, perhaps that's what is holding her down, keeping her on the earth, is a guitar. And Nick thinks in the dream, that's what a guitar sounds like. Nice. He feels he could just stand where he is for the rest of the day, watching the old black woman sitting on her porch held up by jack lifters in the middle of all this Nebraska corn. Stand here west of Omaha and a little north of Osceola in the county of Polk, listening. Her face is seamed with a million wrinkles, like the map of a state where the geography hasn't settled down. Rivers and canyons along her brown leather cheeks, ridges below the knob of her chin, the sinuous raised drumlin of bone at the base of her forehead, the caves of her eyes. She has begun to sing again, accompanying herself on the old guitar. Jesus, won't you come by year? Oh, Jesus, won't you come by year? Jesus, won't you come by here? 'Cause now is the needy time. Oh, now is the needy time. Now is the... Say, boy, who nailed you to that spot? She puts the guitar across her lap like a baby and gestures him forward. Nick comes. He says he just wanted to listen to her sing. The singing was beautiful. Well, singing's God's foolishness. I do it most the day now.
How you making out with that black man?
He scares me. I'm afraid.
Boy, you got to be afraid. Even a tree at dusk, if you see it the right way, you got to be afraid. We're all mortal, praise God.
But how do I tell him no?
How do you breathe? How do you dream?
No one knows.
But you come see me. Anytime. Mother Abigail is what they call me. I'm the oldest woman in these parts, I guess, and I still make my own biscuit. You come see me any time, boy, and bring your friends.
But how do I get out of this?
God bless you, boy, no one ever does. You just look up to the best and come see Mother Abigail any time you take a mind to. I'll be right here, I guess. Don't move around much anymore. So you come see me. I'll be right here. Right here.
He came awake bit by bit until Nebraska was gone, and the smell of the corn and Mother Abigail's seamed dark face. The real world filtered in, not so much replacing that dream world as overlaying it until it was out of sight. He was in Shoyo, Arkansas. His name was Nick Andros. He had never spoken nor heard the sound of a guitar, but he was still alive. He sat up on the cot, swung his legs over, and looked at the scrape. The swelling had gone down some. The ache was only a throb. I'm healing, he thought with great relief. I think I'm going to be okay. He got up from the cot and limped over to the window in his shorts. The leg was stiff, but it was the kind of stiffness you know will work out with a little exercise. He looked out at the silent town, not Shoyo anymore, but the corpse of Shoyo, and knew he would have to leave today. He wouldn't be able to get far, but he would make a start. Where to go? Well, he supposed he knew that. Dreams were just dreams, but for a start he supposed he could go northwest, toward Nebraska. Nick pedaled out of town at about 1:15 on the afternoon of July 3rd. He packed a knapsack in the morning, putting in some more of the penicillin pills in case he needed them, and some canned goods. He went heavy on the Campbell's tomato soup and the Chef Boyardee ravioli, two of his favorites. He put in several boxes of bullets for the pistol and took a canteen. He walked up the street, looking in garages until he found what he wanted, a 10-speed bike that was just about right for his height. He pedaled carefully down Main Street, in a low gear, his hurt leg slowly warming to the work. He was moving west, and his shadow followed him, riding its own black bike. He went past the gracious, cool-looking houses on the outskirts of town, standing in the shade with their curtains drawn for all time. He camped that night in a farmhouse 10 miles west of Shoyo. By nightfall on July 4th, he was nearly to Oklahoma. That evening, before he went to sleep, he stood in another farmyard, his face turned up to the sky, watching a meteor shower scratch the night with cold white fire. He thought he had never seen anything so beautiful. Whatever lay ahead, he was glad to be alive. Chapter 41. Larry woke up at 8:30 to sunlight and the sound of birds. They both freaked him out. Every morning since they had left New York City, sunlight and the sound of birds. As an extra added attraction, a bonus free gift, if you like, the air smelled clean and fresh. Even Rita had noticed it. He kept thinking, well, that's as good as it's going to get. But it kept getting better. It got better until you wondered what they had been doing to the planet. And it made you wonder if this was the way the air had always smelled in places like upstate Minnesota and in Oregon and on the western slope of the Rockies. Lying in his half of the double sleeping bag under the low canvas roof of the two-man tent they had added to their traveling kit in Passaic on the morning of July 2nd, Larry remembered when Al Spellman, one of the tattered remnants, had tried to persuade Larry to go on a camping trip with him and two or three other guys. They were going to go east, stop in Vegas for a night, then go on to a place called Loveland, Colorado. They were going to camp out in the mountains above Loveland for 5 days or so. You can leave all that Rocky Mountain High shit for John Denver, Larry had scoffed. You'll all come back with mosquito bites and probably with a good case of poison ivy up the kazoo from shitting in the woods.
Now, if you change your mind and decide to camp out at the dunes in Vegas for 5 days, give me a jingle. But maybe it had been like this. On your own, with nobody hassling you, except for Rita, and he guessed he could put up with her hassle. Breathing good air and sleeping at night with no tossing and turning, just bang, fast asleep, like somebody had hit you on the head with a hammer. No problems, except which way you were going tomorrow and how much time you could make. It was pretty wonderful. And this morning in Bennington, Vermont, now headed due east along Highway 9, this morning was something special. It was the by God 4th of July, Independence Day. He sat up in the sleeping bag and looked over at Rita, but she was still out like a light, nothing showing but the lines of her body under the bag's quilted fabric and a fluff of her hair. Well, he would wake her up in style this morning. Larry unzipped his side of the bag and got out, buck naked. For a moment his flesh marbled into goosebumps, and then the air felt naturally warm, probably 70 already. It was going to be another peach of a day. He crawled out of the tent and stood up. Parked beside the tent was a 1200cc Harley-Davidson cycle, black and chrome. Like the sleeping bag and the tent, it had been acquired in Passaic. By that time, they had already gone through 3 cars, 2 blocked by terrible traffic jams, the 3rd stuck in the mud outside of Nutley when he had tried to swing around a 2-truck smash-up. The bike was the answer. It could be trundled around accidents, pulling itself along in low gear. When the traffic was seriously piled up, it could be ridden along the breakdown lane or the sidewalk, if there was one. Rita didn't like it. Riding Pillion made her nervous and she clung to Larry desperately, but she had agreed it was the only practical solution. Mankind's final traffic jam had been a dilly, and since they had left Passaic and gotten into the country, they had made great time. By the evening of July 2nd, they had recrossed into New York State and had pitched their tent on the outskirts of Quarryville, with the hazed and mystic Catskills to the west. They turned east on the afternoon of the 3rd, crossing into Vermont just as dusk fell. And here they were in Bennington. They had camped on a rise outside of town, and now, as Larry stood naked beside the cycle, urinating, he could look down and marvel at the picture postcard New England town below him. 2 clean white churches, their steeples rising as if to poke through the blue morning sky. A private school, gray fieldstone buildings shackled with ivy. A mill, a couple of red brick school buildings, plenty of trees dressed in summer green gowns. The only thing that made the picture subtly wrong was the lack of smoke from the mill and the number of twinkling toy cars parked at weird angles on the main street, which was also the highway they were following. But in the sunny silence, silent that was, except for an occasional twittering bird, Larry might have echoed the sentiments of the late Irma Fayette, had he known the lady. No great loss. Except it was the 4th of July, and he supposed he was still an American. He cleared his throat, spat, and hummed a little to find his pitch. He drew his breath, very much aware of the light morning breeze on his naked chest and buttocks, and burst into song. Oh, say, can you see, by the dawn's early light, what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming? He sang it all the way through, facing Bennington, doing a little burlesque bump and grind at the end, because by now Rita would be standing at the flap of the tent, smiling at him. He finished with a snappy salute at the building he thought might be the Bennington Courthouse, then turned around, thinking the best way to start another year of independence in the good old U.S. of A. would be with a good old all-American fuck. Larry Underwood, boy patriot, wishes you a very good But the tent flap was still closed, and he felt a momentary irritation with her again. He squashed it resolutely. She couldn't be on his wavelength all the time, that's all. When you could recognize that and deal with it, you were on your way to an adult relationship. He had been trying very hard with Rita since that harrowing experience in the tunnel, and he thought he'd been doing pretty well. You had to put yourself in her place, that was the thing. You had to recognize that she was a lot older. She'd been used to having things a certain way for most of her life. It was natural for her to have a harder job adapting to a world that had turned itself upside down. The pills, for instance. He hadn't been overjoyed to discover that she had brought her whole fucking pharmacy along with her in a jelly jar with a screw-on lid. Yellow jackets, quaaludes, Darvon, and some other stuff that she called my little pick-me-ups. The little pick-me-ups were reds. Three of those with a shot of tequila, and you would jitter and jive all the livelong day. He didn't like it because too many ups and downs and all-arounds added up to one mean monkey on your back. A monkey roughly the size of King Kong. And he didn't like it because, when he got right down to where the cheese binds, it was a kind of slap in the face at him, wasn't it? What did she have to be nervous about? Why should she have trouble dropping off at night? He sure as hell didn't. And wasn't he taking care of her? You were damn tootin' he was. He went back to the tent, then hesitated for a moment. Maybe he ought to let her sleep. Maybe she was worn out. But he looked down at old Sparky, and old Sparky didn't really want to let her sleep. Singing the old Star-Speckled Banana had turned him right on. So Larry turned back the tent flap and crawled in. Rita? And it hit him right away after the fresh morning cleanness of the air outside. He must have been mostly asleep before to have missed it. The smell was not overpoweringly strong because the tent was fairly well ventilated, but it was strong enough. The sweet-sour smell of vomit and sickness. Rita? He felt mounting alarm at the still way she was lying, just that dry fluff of her hair sticking out of the sleeping bag. He crawled toward her on his hands and knees, the smell of vomit stronger now, making his stomach knot. Rita? You all right? Wake up, Rita. No movement. So he rolled her over, and the sleeping bag was halfway unzipped as if she had tried to struggle out of it in the night, maybe realizing what was happening to her, struggling and failing, and he all the time sleeping peacefully beside her, old Mr. Rocky Mountain High himself. He rolled her over, and one of her pill bottles fell out of her hand, and her eyes were cloudy dull marbles behind half-closed lids, and her mouth was filled with the green puke she had strangled on. He stared into her dead face for what seemed a very long time. They were almost nose to nose, and the tent seemed to be getting hotter and hotter until it was like an attic on a late August afternoon just before the cooling thunder showers hit. His head seemed to be swelling and swelling. Her mouth was full of that shit. He couldn't take his eyes off that. The question that ran around and around in his brain like a mechanical rabbit on a dog track rail was, how long was I sleeping with her after she died? Repulsive, man. Repulsive. The paralysis broke, and he scrambled out of the tent, scraping both knees when they came off the ground sheet and onto the naked earth. He thought he was going to puke himself, and he struggled with it, willing himself not to. He hated to puke worse than anything. And then he thought, but I was going back in there to fuck her, man. And everything came up in a loose rush, and he crawled away from the steaming mess, crying and hating the cruddy taste in his mouth and nose. He thought about her most of the morning. He felt a measure of relief that she had died. A great measure, actually. He would never tell anyone that. It confirmed everything his mother had said about him, and Wayne Stuckey, and even that silly bit of fluff with the apartment near Fordham University. Larry Underwood, the Fordham Flasher. "I ain't no nice guy," he said aloud. And having said it, he felt better. It became easier to tell the truth, and truth-telling was the most important thing. He had made an agreement with himself in whatever back room of the subconscious where the powers behind the throne wheel and deal, that he was going to take care of her. Maybe he wasn't no nice guy, but he was no murderer either, and what he had done in the tunnel was pretty close to attempted murder. So he was going to take care of her. He wasn't going to shout at her, no matter how pissed he got sometimes, like when she grabbed him with her patented Kansas City clutch as they mounted the Harley. He wasn't going to get mad, no matter how much she held him back or how stupid she could be about some things. The night before last, she had put a can of peas in the coals of their fire without ventilating the top, and he had fished it out all charred and swelled about 3 seconds before it would have gone off like a bomb, maybe blinding them with flying hooks of tin shrapnel. But had he read her out about it? No, he hadn't. He had made a light joke and passed it off. Same with the pills. He had figured the pills were her business. Maybe you should have discussed it with her. Maybe she wanted you to. It wasn't a friggin' encounter session, he said aloud. It was survival, and she hadn't been able to cut it. Maybe she had known it ever since the day in Central Park, when she had taken a careless shot at a chinaberry tree with a cheap-looking .32 that might have blown up in her hand. Maybe shit, Larry said angrily. He tipped the canteen up to his mouth, but it was empty, and he still had that slimy taste in his mouth. Maybe there were people like her all over the country. The flu didn't just leave survivor types. Why the hell should it? There might be a young guy somewhere in the country right now, perfect physical condition, immune to the flu but dying of tonsillitis. As Henny Youngman might have said, hey, folks, I got a million of them. Larry was sitting on a paved scenic turnout just off the highway. The view of Vermont marching away to New York in the golden morning haze was breathtaking. A sign announced that this was 12-mile point. Actually, Larry thought he could see a lot farther than 12 miles. On a clear day, you could see forever. At the far side of the turnout, there was a knee-high rock wall, the rocks cemented together, and a few smashed Budweiser bottles. Also a used condom. He supposed that high school kids used to come up here at twilight and watch the lights come on in the town below. First they would get exalted, and then they would get laid. BFD, as they used to say. Big fucking deal. So why was he feeling so bad, anyway? He was telling the truth, wasn't he? Yes. And the worst of the truth was that he felt relief, wasn't it? That the stone around his neck was gone. No, the worst is being alone. Being lonely. Corny, but true. He wanted someone to share this view with, someone he could turn to and say with modest wit, on a clear day you can see forever. And the only company was in a tent a mile and a half back with a mouthful of green puke, getting stiff, drawing flies. Larry put his head on his knees and closed his eyes. He told himself he wouldn't cry. He hated to cry almost as bad as he hated to puke. In the end, he was chicken. He couldn't bury her. He summoned up the worst thoughts he could, maggots and beetles, the woodchucks that would smell her and come in for a munch, the unfairness of one human being leaving another like a candy wrapper or a discarded Pepsi can. But there also seemed to be something vaguely illegal about burying her, and to tell the truth, and he was telling the truth now, wasn't he, that was just a cheap rationalization. He could face going down to Bennington and breaking into the ever-popular hardware store, taking the ever-popular spade and a matching ever-popular pick. He could even face coming back up here, where it was still and beautiful, and digging the ever-popular grave near the ever-popular 12-mile point. But to go back into that tent, which would now smell very much like the comfort station on Transverse No. 1 in Central Park, where the ever-popular dark sweet treat would be sitting for eternity, and unzip her side of the sleeping bag the rest of the way and pull out her stiff and baggy body and drag it up to the hole by the armpits and tumble it in and then shovel the dirt over it, watching the earth patter on her white legs with their bulging nodules of varicose veins and stick in her hair. Uh-uh, buddy. Guess I'll sit this one out. If I'm a chicken, so be it. Plucka, plucka, plucka. He went back to where the tent was pitched and turned back the flap. He found a long stick. He took a deep breath of fresh air, held it, and hooked his clothes out with the stick. Backed away with them, put them on. Took another deep breath, held it, and used the stick to fish out his boots. He sat on a fallen tree and put them on, too. The smell was in his clothes. Bullshit, he whispered. He could see her, half in and half out of the sleeping bag, her stiff hand held out and still curled around the pill bottle that was no longer there. Her half-lidded eyes seemed to be staring at him accusingly. It made him think of the tunnel again, and his visions of the walking dead. Quickly he used the stick to close the tent flap. But he could still smell her on him. So he made Bennington his first stop after all, and in the Bennington men's shop he stripped off all his clothes and got new ones, 3 changes plus 4 pairs of socks and shorts. He even found a new pair of boots. Looking at himself in the 3-way mirror, he could see the empty store spread out behind him and the Harley leaning raffishly at the curb. Sharp threads, he murmured. Heavy, heavy. But there was no one to admire his taste. He left the store and gunned the Harley into life. He supposed he should stop at the hardware store and see if they had a tent and another sleeping bag, but all he wanted now was to get out of Bennington. He would stop farther up the line. He looked up toward where the land made its slow rise as he guided the Harley out of town, and he could see 12 Mile Point, but not where they had pitched the tent. That was really all for the best. It was... Larry looked back at the road, and terror jumped nimbly down his throat. An International Harvester pickup towing a horse trailer had swerved to avoid a car, and the horse trailer had overturned. He was going to drive the Harley right into it because he hadn't been looking where he was going. He turned hard right, his new boot dragging on the road, and he almost got around, but the left footrest clipped the trailer's rear bumper and yanked the bike out from under him. Larry came to rest on the highway's verge with a bone-rattling thump. The Harley chattered on for a moment behind him and then stalled out. "You all right?" he asked aloud. Thank God he'd only been doing 20 or so. Thank God Rita wasn't with him. She'd be bullshit out of her mind with hysterics. Of course, if Rita had been with him, he wouldn't have been looking up there in the first place. He would have been TCB, taking care of business to the cubistic among you. "I'm all right," he answered himself. But he still wasn't sure he was. He sat up. The quiet impressed itself upon him as it did from time to time. It was so quiet that if you thought about it, you could go crazy. Even Rita bawling would have been a relief at this point. Everything seemed suddenly full of bright twinkles. And with sudden horror, he thought he was going to pass out. He thought, "I really am hurt. In just a minute I'll feel it when the shock wears off. That's when I'll feel it. I'm cut bad or something, and who's going to put on a tourniquet?" But when the instant of faintness had passed, he looked at himself and thought he was probably all right after all. He had cut both hands, and his new pants had shredded away at the right knee. The knee was also cut, but they were all just scrapes, and what the fuck was the big deal? Anybody could dump their cycle. It happens to everybody once in a while. But he knew what the big deal was. He could have hit his head the right way and fractured his skull, and he would have lain there in the hot sun until he died, or strangled to death on his own puke like a certain now-deceased friend of his. He walked shakily over to the Harley and stood it up. It didn't seem to be damaged in any way, but it looked different. Before, it had just been a machine, a rather charming machine that could serve the dual purpose of transporting him and making him feel like James Dean or Jack Nicholson in Hell's Angels on Wheels. But now its chrome seemed to grin at him like a sideshow barker, seeming to invite him to step right up and see if he was man enough to ride the two-wheeled monster. It started on the third kick, and he putted out of Bennington at no more than walking speed. He was wearing bracelets of cold sweat on his arms, and suddenly he had never, no, never, in his whole life, wanted so badly to see another human face. But he didn't see one that day. In the afternoon he made himself speed up a little, but he could not force himself to twist the throttle any farther once the speedometer needle had reached 20, not even if he could see the road was clear ahead. There was a sporting goods and cycle shop on the outskirts of Wilmington, and he stopped there and got a sleeping bag, some heavy gloves, and a helmet, and even with the helmet on, he could not force himself to go faster than 25. On blind corners he slowed down until he was walking the big cycle along. He kept having visions of lying unconscious at the side of the road and bleeding to death unattended. At 5 o'clock, as he was approaching Brattleboro, the Harley's overheat light went on. Larry parked it and turned it off with mingled feelings of relief and disgust. "You might as well have pushed it," he said. "It's meant to run at 60, you goddamn fool." He left it and walked into town, not knowing if he would come back for it. He slept on the Brattleboro Municipal Common that evening, under the partial shelter of the band shell. He turned in as soon as it was dark and fell asleep instantly. Some sound woke him with a jerk a time later. He looked at his watch. The thin radium lines on the dial scratched out 11:20. He got up on one elbow and stared into the darkness, feeling the band shell huge around him, missing the little tent that had held in body heat. What a fine little canvas womb it had been. If there had been a sound, it was gone now. Even the crickets had fallen silent. Was that right? Could it be right? "Is someone there?" Larry called. And the sound of his own voice frightened him.
He groped for the 30-30 and for a long and increasingly panicky moment could not find it. When he did, he squeezed the trigger without thinking, just as a man drowning in the ocean will squeeze a thrown life preserver. If the safety hadn't been on, he would have fired it, possibly into himself. There was something in the silence. He was sure of it. Perhaps a person, perhaps some large and dangerous animal. Of course, a person could be dangerous, too. A person like the one who had repeatedly stabbed the poor monster shouter, or like John Beresford Tipton, who had offered him $1 million in cold cash for the use of his woman. "Who is it?" He had a flashlight in his pack, but in order to hunt for it, he would have to let go of the rifle which he had drawn across his lap. Besides, did he really want to see who it was? So he just sat there, willing movement or a repetition of the sound which had awakened him. Had it been a sound, or just something he had dreamed? And after a little while he first nodded, then dozed off. Suddenly his head jerked up, his eyes wide, his flesh shrinking against his bones. Now there was sound, and if the night hadn't been cloudy, the moon, nearly full, would have shown him. But he didn't want to see. No, he most definitely didn't want to see. Yet he sat forward, head cocked, listening to the sound of dusty boot heels clocking away from him down the sidewalk of Main Street, Brattleboro, Vermont, moving west, fading, until they were lost in the open hum of things. Larry felt a sudden mad urge to stand up, letting the sleeping bag slither down around his ankles, to shout, "Come back, whoever you are, I don't care, come back!" But did he really want to issue such a blank check to whoever? The band shell would amplify his shout, his plea. And what if those boot heels actually did return, growing louder in a stillness where not even the crickets sang? Instead of standing, he lay back down and curled up in the fetal position with his hands wrapped around the rifle. "I won't sleep again tonight," he thought. But he was asleep in 3 minutes, and quite sure the next morning that he had dreamed the whole thing. Chapter 42. While Larry Underwood was taking his 4th of July spill only a state away, Stuart Redman was sitting on a large rock at the side of the road and eating his lunch. He heard the sound of approaching engines. He finished his can of beer to swallow and carefully folded over the top of the waxed paper tube the Ritz crackers were in. His rifle was leaning against the rock beside him. He picked it up, flicked off the safety catch, and then put it down again, a little closer to hand. Motorcycles coming, small ones by the sound. 250s? In this great stillness it was impossible to tell how far away they were. 10 miles, maybe, but only maybe. Plenty of time to eat more if he wanted to, but he didn't. In the meantime, the sun was warm and the thought of meeting fellow creatures pleasant. He had seen no living people since leaving Glenn Bateman's house in Woodsville. He glanced at the rifle again. He had flicked the safety because the fellow creatures might turn out to be like Elder. He had left the rifle leaning against the rock because he hoped they would be like Bateman, only not quite so glum about the future. "Society will reappear," Bateman had said. "Notice I didn't use the word reform. That would have been a ghastly pun. There's precious little reform in the human race." But Bateman himself hadn't wanted to get in on the ground floor of society's reappearance. He seemed perfectly content, at least for the time being, to go for his walks with Kojak, paint his pictures, putter around his garden, and think about the sociological ramifications of nearly total decimation. "If you come back this way and renew your invitation to jine up, Stu, I'll probably agree. That is the curse of the human race, sociability. What Christ should have said was, 'Yea, verily, whenever two or three of you are gathered together, some other guy is going to get the living shit knocked out of him.' Shall I tell you what sociology teaches us about the human race? I'll give it to you in a nutshell. Show me a man or woman alone, and I'll show you a saint. Give me two, and they'll fall in love. Give me three, and they'll invent the charming thing we call society. Give me four, and they'll build a pyramid. Give me five, and they'll make one an outcast. Give me six, and they'll reinvent prejudice. Give me seven, and in 7 years they'll reinvent warfare.
Man may have been made in the image of God, but human society was made in the image of his opposite number, and is always trying to get back home. Was that true? If it was, then God help them. Just lately, Stu had been thinking a great deal about old friends and acquaintances. In his memory, there was a great tendency to downplay or completely forget their unlovable characteristics, the way Bill Hapscom used to pick his nose and wipe the snot on the sole of his shoe, Norm Bruett's heavy hand with his kids, Billy Vereker's unpleasant method of controlling the cat population around his house by crushing the thin skulls of the new kittens under the heels of his Range Rider boots. The thoughts that came wanted to be wholly good, going hunting at dawn, bundled up in quilted jackets and day-glow orange vests, poker games at Ralph Hodges's house, and Willie Craddock always complaining about how he was $4 in the game even if he was 20 ahead. Six or seven of them pushing Tony Leominster's scout back onto the road that time he went down into the ditch drunk out of his mind, Tony staggering around and swearing to God and all the saints that he had swerved to avoid a U-Haul full of Mexican wetbacks. Jesus, how they had laughed. Chris Ortega's endless stream of ethnic jokes. Going down to Huntsville for whores, and that time Joe Bob Brentwood caught the crabs and tried to tell everybody they came from the sofa in the parlor and not from the girl upstairs. They had been goddamn good times. Not what your sophisticates with their nightclubs and their fancy restaurants and their museums would think of as good times, maybe, but good times just the same. He thought about those things, went over them and over them, the way an old recluse will lay out hand after hand of solitaire from a greasy pack of cards. Mostly he wanted to hear other human voices, get to know someone, be able to turn to someone and say, "Did you see that?" when something happened like the meteor shower he had watched the other night. He was not a talkative man, but he did not care much for being alone, and never had. So he sat up a little straighter when the motorcycles finally swept around the bend, and he saw they were a couple of Honda 250s, ridden by a boy of about 18 and a girl who was maybe older than the boy. The girl was wearing a bright yellow blouse and light blue Levi's. They saw him sitting on the rock, and both Hondas swerved a little as their driver's surprise caused control to waver briefly. The boy's mouth dropped open. For a moment it was unclear whether they would stop or just speed by heading west. Stu raised an empty hand and said, "Hi," in an amiable voice. His heart was beating heavily in his chest. He wanted them to stop. They did. For a moment he was puzzled by the tenseness in their postures, particularly the boy. He looked as if a gallon of adrenaline had just been dumped into his blood. Of course, Stu had a rifle, but he wasn't holding it on them, and they were armed themselves. He was wearing a pistol, and she had a small deer rifle slung across her back on a strap, like an actress playing Patty Hearst with no great conviction. "I think he's all right, Harold," the girl said. But the boy she called Harold continued to stand astride his bike, looking at Stu with an expression of surprise and considering antagonism. "I said I think," she began again. "How are we supposed to know that?" Harold snapped without taking his eyes off Stu. "Well, I'm glad to see you, if that makes any difference," Stu said. "What if I don't believe you?" Harold challenged, and Stu saw that he was scared green. Scared by him and by his responsibility to the girl. "Well, then, I don't know." Stu climbed off the rock. Harold's hand jittered toward his holstered pistol. "Harold, you leave that alone," the girl said. Then she fell silent, and for a moment they all seemed helpless to proceed further, a group of three dots which, when connected, would form a triangle whose exact shape could not yet be foreseen. "Oh," Franny said, easing herself down on a mossy patch at the base of an elm beside the road. "I'm never going to get the calluses off my fanny, Harold." Harold uttered a surly grunt. She turned to Stu. "Have you ever ridden 170 miles on a Honda, Mr. Redman? Not recommended." Stu smiled. "Where are you headed?" "What business is it of yours?" Harold asked rudely. "And what kind of attitude is that?" Fran asked him. "Mr. Redman is the first person we've seen since Gus Dinsmore died. I mean, if we didn't come looking for other people, what did we come for?" "He's watching out for you, is all," Stu said quietly.
He picked a piece of grass and put it between his lips.
"That's right, I am," Harold said, unmollified. "I thought we were watching out for each other," she said, and Harold flushed darkly.
Stu thought, "Give me three people and they'll form a society." But were these the right two for his one? He liked the girl, but the boy impressed him as a frightened blowhard, and a frightened blowhard could be a very dangerous man under the right circumstances, or the wrong ones.
"Whatever you say," Harold muttered.
He shot Stu a lowering look and took a box of Marlboros from his jacket pocket. He lit one. He smoked on it like a fellow who had only recently taken up the habit, like maybe the day before yesterday.
"We're going to Stovington, Vermont," Franny said, "to the plague center there. We..."
"What's wrong, Mr. Redman?"
He had gone pale all of a sudden. The stem of grass he had been chewing fell into his lap.
"Why there?" Stu asked.
"Because there happens to be an installation there for the studying of communicable diseases," Harold said loftily. "It was my thought that, if there is any order left in this country or any persons in authority who escaped the late scourge, they would likely be at Stovington or Atlanta, where there is another such center."
"That's right," Franny said.
Stu said, "You're wasting your time." Franny looked stunned. Harold looked indignant. The red began to creep out of his collar again.
"I hardly think you're the best judge of that, my man."
"I guess I am. I came from there." Now they both looked stunned, stunned and astonished.
"You knew about it?" Franny asked, shaken. "You checked it out?"
"No, it wasn't like that. It..."
"You're a liar!"
Harold's voice had gone high and squeaky. Fran saw an alarming cold flash of anger in Redman's eyes. Then they were brown and mild again.
"No, I ain't."
"I say you are. I say you're nothing but a..."
"Harold, you shut up!"
Harold looked at her, wounded.
"But, Franny, how can you believe... How can you be so rude and antagonistic?"
she asked hotly.
"Will you at least listen to what he has to say, Harold?"
"I don't trust him."
"Fair enough," Stu thought. "That makes us even."
"How can you not trust a man you just met? Really, Harold, you're being disgusting."
"Let me tell you how I know," Stu said quietly. He told an abridged version of the story that began when Campion had crashed into Hap's pumps. He sketched his escape from Stovington a week ago. Harold glared dully down at his hands, which were plucking up bits of moss and shredding them. But the girl's face was like an unfolding map of tragic country, and Stu felt bad for her. She had set off with this boy, who, to give him credit, had had a pretty good idea, hoping against hope that there was something of the old, taken-for-granted ways left. Well, she had been disappointed, bitterly so, from her look.
"Atlanta, too? The play got both of them?" she asked.
"Yes," he said, and she burst into tears. He wanted to comfort her, but the boy would not take to that. Harold glanced uncomfortably at Fran, then down at the litter of moss on his cuffs. Stu gave her his handkerchief. She thanked him distractedly, without looking up. Harold glared sullenly at him, the eyes those of a piggy little boy who wants the whole cookie jar to himself. "Ain't he going to be surprised," Stu thought, "when he finds out a girl isn't a jar of cookies?" When her tears had tapered down to sniffles, she said,
"I guess Harold and I owe you our thanks. At least you saved us a long trip with disappointment at the end."
"You mean you believe him, just like that? He tells you a big story and you just... you buy it?"
"Harold, why would he lie? For what gain?"
"Well, how do I know what he's got on his mind?" Harold asked truculently. "Murder could be, or rape."
"I don't believe in rape myself," Stu said mildly. "Maybe you know something about it I don't."
"Stop it," Fran said. "Harold, won't you try not to be so awful?"
"Awful?" Harold shouted. "I'm trying to watch out for you, us, and that's so bloody damn awful."
"Look," Stu said, and brushed his sleeve up.
On the inside of his elbow were several healing needle marks and the last remains of a discolored bruise.
"They injected me with all kinds of stuff."
"Maybe you're a junkie," Harold said. Stu rolled his sleeve back down without replying. It was the girl, of course. He had gotten used to the idea of owning her. Well, some girls could be owned and some could not.
This one looked like the latter type. She was tall and pretty and very fresh-looking. Her dark eyes and hair accentuated a look that could be taken for dewy helplessness. It would be easy to miss that faint line, the "I want" line, Stu's mother had called it, between her eyebrows that became so pronounced when she was put out, the swift capability of her hands, even the forthright way she tossed her hair from her forehead. "So now what do we do?" she asked, ignoring Harold's last contribution to the discussion entirely. "Go on anyway," Harold said. And when she looked over at him with that line furrowing her brow, he added hastily, "Well, we have to go somewhere. Sure, he's probably telling the truth, but we could double-check, then decide what's next." Fran glanced at Stu with an "I don't want to hurt your feelings, but" kind of expression. Stu shrugged. "Okay," Harold pressed. "I suppose it doesn't matter," Franny said. She picked up a Gonda seed dandelion and blew away the fluff. "You didn't see anyone at all back the way you came?" Stu asked. "There was a dog that seemed to be all right, no people." "I saw a dog, too." He told them about Bateman and Kojak. When he had finished, he said, "I was going toward the coast, but you saying there aren't any people back that way kind of takes the wind out of my sails." "Sorry," Harold said, sounding anything but. He stood up. "Ready, Fran?" She looked at Stu, hesitated, then stood up. "Back to the wonderful diet machine. Thank you for telling us what you know, Mr. Redman, even if the news wasn't so hot." "Just a second," Stu said, also standing up. He hesitated, wondering again if they were right. The girl was, but the boy surely was 17 and afflicted with a bad case of the "I hate most everybody's." But were there enough people left to pick and choose? Stu thought not. "I guess we're both looking for people," he said. "I'd like to tag along with you if you'd have me." "No," Harold said instantly. Fran looked from Harold to Stu, troubled. "You never mind, I say no." "Don't I get a vote? What's the matter with you? Can't you see he only wants one thing? Christ, Fran!"
"Three's better than two if there's trouble," Stu said. "And I know it's better than one."
"No," Harold repeated. His hand dropped to the butt of his gun. "Yes," Fran said. "We'd be glad to have you, Mr. Redman." Harold rounded on her, his face angry and hurt. Stu tightened for just a moment, thinking that perhaps he was going to strike her, and then relax again. "That's the way you feel, is it? You were just waiting for some excuse to get rid of me, I get it." He was so angry that tears had sprung to his eyes, and that made him angrier still.
"If that's the way you want it, okay. You go on with him. I'm done with you."
He stamped off toward where the Hondas were parked. Franny looked at Stu with stricken eyes, then turned toward Harold. "Just a minute," Stu said. "Stay here, please."
"Don't hurt him," Fran said. "Please."
Stu trotted toward Harold, who was astride his Honda and trying to start it up. In his anger, he had twisted the throttle all the way over, and it was a good thing for him it was flooded, Stu thought. If it actually started up with that much throttle, it would rear back on its rear wheel like a unicycle and pile old Harold into the first tree and land on top of him.
"You stay away!"
Harold screamed angrily at him, and his hand fell onto the butt of the gun again. Stu put his hand on top of Harold's, as if they were playing slapjack. He put his other hand on Harold's arm. Harold's eyes were very wide, and Stu believed he was only an inch or so from becoming dangerous. He wasn't just jealous of the girl. That had been a bad oversimplification on his part. His personal dignity was wrapped up in it, and his new image of himself as the girl's protector. God knew what kind of a fuck-up he had been before all of this, with his wad of belly and his pointy-toed boots and his stuck-up way of talking. But underneath the new image was the belief that he was still a fuck-up, and always would be. Underneath was the certainty that there was no such thing as a fresh start. He would have reacted the same way to Bateman, or to a 12-year-old kid. In any triangle situation, he was going to see himself as the lowest point. "Harold," he said, almost into Harold's ear.
"Let me go!"
His heavy body seemed light in its tension. He was thrumming like a live wire.
"Harold, are you sleeping with her?"
Harold's body gave a shivering jerk, and Stu knew he was not.
None of your business.
No. Except to get things out where we can see them. She's not mine, Harold. She's her own. I'm not going to try to take her away from you. I'm sorry to have to speak so blunt, but it's best for us to know where we stand.